Salo Falava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Jordan Fennell, filling in for Aggie Dubo this morning. Today on the show, Ailava Samuels from Fiji has been crowned Miss Pacific, but concerns have been raised over the pageant scoring system.
There were issues with judges last year. And I'm not satisfied with this course.
And coming up, you'll hear from a New Zealand doctor researching if Pacific medicine can be used to treat diseases like dengue. Also, in PNG, Port Moresby squatter settlements are back in the spotlight after thousands of people were evicted.
People will be properly resettled. They will be going to not a settlement, but a proper planned resettlement to become part of the future of the city.
Those stories and more coming up here on Pacific Beat, coming to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. We're going to start in Fiji, though, where all eyes are on the Miss Pacific Islands pageant.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Miss Pacific Islands pageant 2026 is Miss Fiji, Ailava Samuels!
I'm just speechless. I'd like to take this moment to acknowledge God. You know, give Him back all the glory and honor. Acknowledge my supporters from Fiji, from all the Pacific countries. Thank you. Thank you so much. You know, the crown is not a reward. It's a responsibility. And I'm honored to be given that responsibility.
An emotional Ailava Samuels, the new Miss Pacific, speaking there. She's become the fourth Fijian to win the crown since the start of the regional pageant. Miss Samuels became Fiji's entrant after Miss Fiji Peggy Ravusiru failed to come to an agreement with the organisers of the Miss Fiji crown to represent the country. But on crowning night, Ailava Samuels shone, placing ahead of Papua New Guinea and Samoa. But there was criticism online over the scoring and the use of five Fijian judges by organisers. Anna Bai is the founder and chairlady of the Miss Bird of Paradise, PNG.
I'm actually not satisfied with the results from last night, so we'll be requesting to view the score sheet. So from PNG, that's what we'll be doing, just so that we're not wasting our time attending these pageants. You know, we've been attending. There were issues with judges last year, and I was one that always called for if we could get judges from other countries that are not represented in the pageant. So, I guess they didn't listen to that, and I'm not satisfied with the scores, the results. My girl worked really hard, and so we did all the other contestants, and it's just good to have that satisfaction that there was fairness, yeah. So that's what we'll be requesting for.
Madam, you were told that, there wasn't enough funds and that's why there were a lot of the judges that are Fiji-based. Do you think that is a satisfactory explanation, given that 12 months lead time existed?
Oh, no, that's not satisfactory. That was the reason for Fiji, because there wasn't enough funds to fly in judges from out of the country. And, you know, and they were all rushing everything towards, the crowning time. So I think they ended up getting judges from here. And the PNG judge is not from PNG. She works here in Fiji as well. And so most of these judges, I think they're all Fiji-based. And so I think they could have done a better job If you had 1 year to host this pageant, I'm sure you could have done better than this. Yeah. If in PNG, just for the national pageant, we do provincial pageants, and provinces that participate, we don't get judges from those provinces. So if we can do it in a national pageant, I'm sure at the regional level, this can be done.
Your queen did very well, and you had a big team. Tell me about the kind of investment, the kind of effort put into bringing a queen all the way from Papua New Guinea to Fiji.
Oh, we work so hard. Yeah, we work so hard. It's not easy doing district, you know, coming from the district and then provincial queens, and we bring them to the national. It's a lot of work. But we believe in inclusiveness and fairness in the representation of the country. And so we worked hard. And our young queen, Miss Yampela Popena, she's our queen from the province and the district. So the team, we worked so hard to bring her to Fiji. And she was well prepared. Yeah. And, you know, that is why I'll be asking for scholarships. Yeah.
Anna Bai, the founder and chairlady of the Miss Bird of Paradise PNG, and she was speaking there to the ABC's Lithe Movono. Pacific Beat and the ABC have requested members of the Miss Pacific pageant to join the show and to respond to some of the criticism and questions that have been raised, but we've yet to receive a response from the organisers. However, joining me right now to discuss everything that went down over the weekend at the pageant is ABC's Fiji reporter, Lithe Movono, who is in Nandi for the crowning night. Bula Lithe.
Bula Vinaka and Yandra to you, Jordan.
Lovely to have you joining us. Now tell me, what was the atmosphere like at the pageant?
Well, it was, you know, the Miss Pacific Islands pageant is really always so exciting. It's an explosion of culture and color and also personalities. There are many things to look forward to, from the costumes to the dancing to the advocacy that all of these women do. So it was always going to be very exciting, Jordan. But the moment of the crowning itself, that was quite an unusual one for me. And I've been to a few Miss Pacific Islands pageant. It was really strange situation and atmosphere.
Yeah. And so tell me a little bit about I Love Samuels. She was crowned Miss Pacific. What do we know about her and her journey and how she came to become and get the title?
Miss I Love Samuels has not had an easy journey. It's been a very difficult one for her. She's a very beautiful young lady, talented. A dancer, if I'm not mistaken, is the work that she's been doing over the past year or so since leaving high school. She is the daughter of a well-known fashion designer in Fiji, someone who has dressed leaders and cabinet ministers. So she does not, she's not strange or new to publicity and also the limelight. She won the pageant for the Nasinu town, which is really home to one of the largest part of Fiji's Central Eastern Division. So quite a well-known face here. And she is a regular on the fashion runways, Jordan. But ever since she was given the opportunity to replace Dr. Peggy Ravusiro, who won the Miss Fiji pageant, I Love Her has taken quite a lot of hit from the public, because Dr. Peggy won the Miss Fiji pageant quite spectacularly and garnered quite a lot of public support. So it can't be easy to be in this young woman's shoes right now, Jordan.
Yeah, and you mentioned just before that the moment of the crowning, there was a strange atmosphere. What was the reaction to her win?
Well, it started when she got the prize for best interview. That category, though all of the categories of the Miss Pacific Islands pageant that can take the girl to the top four or the top five are equally weighted, that particular category of best interview, otherwise known as best research topic, is a very difficult one to win, because it's highly academic. Contestants write a 5-minute academic presentation and then they're quizzed on it by the judges. So it requires quite a lot more than one would expect a girl to be able to do. It requires teamwork, it requires academic support, and a lot of great presentation skills. When that particular category is done, people can pretty much tell who the winner is going to be. So when she won it, it was a big surprise. There was pin drop silence, and the cheers only came from the Fiji tables, and people were stunned. There was, throughout the week, expectation that Miss Samoa, who is a lecturer at the Samoa National University, would take that particular category. So it was awkward. And then in the moment of the crowning itself, there are videos now that you'll be able to see online of an awkward silence of people speaking in their own language, and just the Fijian tables, including the Fijian pageant director, cheering really loudly. So it was probably the strangest crowning moment I've ever witnessed, and I've witnessed a few, Jordan.
Yeah, very interesting. And we heard a bit earlier your interview with the Papua New Guinea team, which came in at second place and a bye. She had concerns about the judges and the scoring. I just note that there were five Fijian judges. How many judges were there altogether?
So altogether, there are nine judges. There are five judges who we refer to as the main judges, because they're actually the ones that choose the winner. They choose the person that, you know, goes on to become Miss Pacific Islands. But there's also three special judges is what they're called. These are the judges that judge the special awards. So awards like Miss Photogenic, Miss Tourism. And they're also, however, contrary to popular opinion, they're not minor in the sense that they're also the ones that are involved backstage during the judging of the main categories, because they're the ones that make sure that what you don't see on the stage, things like, are you wearing only the required length of the sarong? Is your traditional attire made only of natural fiber, natural materials? So they do have a hand in how a girl is able to win points when they actually get to the front of stage, onto that stage. And so there were eight judges in total, and then what we call a head judge. And the head judge is a person who more or less acts as coordinator. From the outset, that's what you'll see. But this is also the person that collects the score sheets. This is the person that takes from each judge what their points are going to be, keeps it in a secure location, brings it back out, and works with the auditors or with accountants to do the tallying. So in total, there are nine people involved in how scores are made, collated, and then presented. And of those nine judges, Jordan, at only one of them was flown in from outside of Fiji, and that was the judge that came from American Samoa, and I confirmed this with her immediately after the crowning. Otherwise, the main judges, the five main judges, only the American Samoan, Miss Rosalyn Polu, came from outside of Fiji. The other four are based here. There is a Fiji national, there is a Tuvaluan Kiribati national who works at the University of the South Pacific. There is a fashion designer who has lived here in Fiji for many years. And then there's a diplomat from one of the local Pacific missions, also based here. And so while the rules say that the host nation can have only one judge, it is silent on whether the host nation can choose nationals of Pacific Island countries from within their own country. So that's where I suspect a lot of the confusion is. But in terms of the special judges, they're all Fiji-based. One of them is a Tongan national that has worked in Fiji for at least a decade, if I'm not mistaken. And the other two are also Fiji nationals, Jordan.
And so were there any other teams alongside the PNG team that raised concerns about this?
Yes, Jordan. Immediately after the crowning, we waited for the excitement and the atmosphere to quieten down a bit, and we went to every single delegation. So there were concerns from every single delegation. Some of them told me they're unwilling to go on the mic to say that they had asked for score sheets on the night itself. Some of them had said that they were stunned, that the results were not what they expected, and also questioned questioned the judges, because a lot of them did not get to meet the judges or even know about the judges until well into the week of the pageant. And so it was only the Papua New Guinean delegation who took their time overnight to think about their position and then talk to us on the record the next day. But what they've said is basically representative of almost every other country that was at the Miss Pacific Islands pageant this year.
And have we had any response from the pageant organisers to these concerns?
We did. We asked the organisers. The organisers had three media officers, all of whom immediately left the pageant by the morning after and gave me, standard formal responses to say, I've completed my service, I no longer work for the pageant, and referred us to the pageant secretariat in Samoa. We did, however, write to all of them, the members of the Samoan Tourism Authority, who in fact run the Miss Pacific Islands pageant secretariat, and also to Ms. Anna Tukite, who is the pageant director for both the Miss Fiji pageant and the Miss Pacific Islands pageant, and her secretary. None of them responded except for Ms. Tukite, who copied us in and referred the questions to another gentleman in the Samoa Tourism Authority, who did not respond to us, Jordan.
And so with all of this, how important is the perception of independence and fairness when it comes to a regional pageant like Miss Pacific Islands?
Look, it's absolutely central, some may say. In the Pacific context, pageants are not just, entertainment events. They're platforms for leadership development. They're an opportunity to promote and protect and even to an extent preserve cultural practices. And as Ms. Bai said, it's a matter of national pride for all of the teams that come to the Miss Pacific Islands pageant. And when we speak about the Pacific region and we sometimes... Oh. And 99% of that is Papua New Guinea, Jordan. But it's not just another delegation. They represent the largest Pacific delegation. So for them, it's not about entitlement. It's about, how their country is represented. When organizers are not particularly transparent or don't, explain things that teams are worried about, it can take away from the brand of the Miss Pacific Island pageant. And I want to quote Litara, the outgoing Miss Pacific Islands, who said that it's like a regional canoe, the Miss Pacific Islands pageant. If one side paddles alone, the canoe is going around in circles. And she said, every country must paddle the same way. But she said, when you're talking about promoting and presenting values that are important to Pacific people and Pacific women, it needs to be translated all the way down the line in terms of the way the pageant is organized, Jordan.
And Lithe, with the PNG team raising these concerns and other teams having concerns, what do we know about what happens next?
Well, what normally happens in the procedure of the pageant is that the morning after crowning, there is, of course, a prize-giving ceremony for all of the winners. And then there's usually an exit review board meeting, because remember, board members come in from all around the country, whether they're participating or not. And then they do a review of how the pageant's gone and the decisions that have been made at that year's board meeting and, looking ahead, because they don't meet again until the next Pacific Islands pageant in a year's time. So what I understand from the American Samoan delegation is that they were looking forward to that exit meeting to understand requests for the score sheets, because they too have asked to look at specific score sheets. And so we're waiting on that. We're hoping that either one of the delegations or the organizing committee itself might be able to talk to us about the multiple requests that have gone in for score sheets, and also whether they are responding to allegations of how the judges were selected and how the scores were actually done. Because Jordan, for Pacific people, particularly those that are involved in cultural events of this type, it's not just a crown for them. This is about their cultures and their national identities being presented. And it's not just this girl that is wearing a crown that is on a stage, but instead there is a lot of values behind that entire teams. And as we heard from Ms. Baez, thousands and thousands of dollars involved in bringing a young woman to come and represent their country.
Well, no doubt, Lithe, you'll keep us up to date on any developments moving forward. Thank you so much for bringing us all of that. Have a lovely rest of your day.
Pinaka.
That was ABC's Fiji reporter Lithe Movono speaking to me there.
Pacific Beat.
My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat on this Monday morning and taking you now to Papua New Guinea, where the recent evictions of thousands of people from squatter settlements in Port Moresby has pushed the perennial issue back into the spotlight again. After homes were bulldozed and people left with nothing, public opinion is divided between those who have little sympathy and others who say authorities have acted with callous heavy-handedness. Finau Fanua reports.
Squatter settlements have long been an issue for Port Moresby as people flood in from rural areas to the bright lights of Papua New Guinea's capital city, only to find there's nowhere to live. The issue has come to prominence again with two large-scale evictions in recent weeks. In this video, residents of Four Mile Settlement can be seen leaving the area with their belongings as bulldozers tear down their homes. But Port Moresby Governor Powers Parkop has told the public that those evicted are being assisted with resettlement.
People will be properly resettled. They will be going to not a settlement, but a proper planned resettlement to become part of the future of the city. A planned city, a modern city, a metropolitan city, a capital city, a city that belongs to all of us and we all can be proud of.
In a press conference held last Thursday, Mr. Parkop said landowners had court orders to lawfully evict the squatters and that evictions were not being carried out by the National Capital District Commission, or NCDC, an authority in charge of upgrading Port Moresby settlements into formal suburbs.
NCDC, under my leadership and with my colleagues here, our board and management, is not engaging in an eviction exercise over settlement. That should be very, very clear. No ambiguity. We have not commenced on any eviction exercise against 4 Mile or against 8 Mile or against any other settlement. What is happening is title holders who have title to a particular land have gone to court. There's a process that have gone on over a period of time, maybe months, eventually resulting in eviction orders. And those orders have been migrated to ACP and Metsu as the metropolitan command in the city, and they are obliged under the law to enforce those orders. If they don't enforce it, then it's a problem for them. It's a problem for the law.
Mr. Parkop was also critical of squatters, particularly those in 2 Mile Hill, who he says had been amply warned and consulted.
We have given the people of 2 Mile more than enough time, enough warning. We have tolerated the situation at 2 Mile. We have given them the opportunity to change their ways, to renounce violence, to respect each other. Correct. But did they respect that? No, God.
People are now confused. They are traumatized. They don't actually know where to go.
That was Stanley Tony, a primary school principal and one of those evicted from the 4 Mile settlements. Mr. Tony says he and thousands of others, including women and children, have been mistreated and forced into homelessness.
The eviction that took place is very inhumane. And, according to humanitarian grounds, it must be honored through a process by, getting us a resettlement package, providing us land and, getting us all those basic amenities correct before they do any evictions.
On social media, many openly support the evictions, saying the squatters were there illegally and citing the area as a hub for crime. However, images of women and children being evicted has also alarmed many.
It's very hard for the mothers, women, especially women and children, and they are roaming around. It's that eviction really affect the women and children.
Vice President of the Council of Women in Port Moresby, Sana Dokopa, says the indignity of mass evictions could have been prevented if the Lands Department transferred some of its authority to the NCDC.
To give title to the settlers, each Lands Department has a power. So as a women leader, I can recommend in future, like the Lands Department has to give some of those powers there to commission, NCDC commission, to relocate all settlement to suburbs. So Lands Department has to give some power back to NCDC commission.
The emergence of large informal and illegal settlements in Port Moresby has been blamed on a variety of factors, from poverty to poor urban planning. Barbara Kamande, a social justice campaigner and researcher, says housing costs are too high and that the problem has been exacerbated by a population boom.
The housing price, the rentals are very, very high in this country. The rental fees charged by landlords or service providers need to be regulated so people can afford cheap and decent accommodation.
Contrary to popular belief, she says many settlers are employed and are medium income earners. While acknowledging the legality of the evictions, Ms. Kamande condemned the conduct in which they were carried out.
The issue is in the manner in which people have been evicted and the timing of the eviction. The people were evicted during rainy season, and it was beginning of the 2026 school year. And that is very insensitive to the fact that school children were affected, and women who are the homekeepers are also affected. Their household properties are being destroyed, and they're thinking, where are they going to sleep and where are they going to pay for the family members? And so that's a concern. But otherwise, the people also need to realize that they cannot just go and put up a permanent building anywhere in the city or in an urban center.
That was Barbara Kamande, a Papua New Guinean social justice campaigner and researcher speaking there.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
That's right. This is Pacific Beat. My name is Jordan Fennell with you here on this Monday morning. Now, traditional medicines in Samoa and New Zealand are currently being studied to treat illnesses like dengue, Zika and measles. Dr. Natalie Netzler, a senior lecturer at the University of Auckland, is investigating this and she joins me this morning to chat about it. Kia ora, doctor, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Aloha, lava. Thank you for having me.
Lovely to have you. Dr. Netzler, tell me about this study that you're looking at. How has this come about?
Yeah, so it's sort of come from a number of different strands that are being woven together. So the first major issue is that out of the almost 300 viral diseases that cause human harm, we, despite all of modern medicine, only have a small number of tools to combat these viral diseases. So there are only only vaccines to prevent around 25 viral diseases, and there are only antivirals to stop about 11 types of viruses that cause disease. And so you can see there's this huge gap, and it leaves billions of people worldwide vulnerable to a lot of these different viruses, particularly things like measles, which is seeing a huge upsurge, and of course dengue and Zika, with dengue being a massive issue in the Pacific right now. The other issue is that these viruses such as measles, dengue and Zika that have this huge impact on the Pacific, they have no antivirals available. So there are no solutions. And growing up, my dad was born and raised in Samoa, and through my mum, we have heritage to Indigenous Māori here in Aotearoa, New Zealand. And so growing up, I was exposed to traditional medicines. If we had a headache, we would go to dad, who would give us a traditional Samoan fofoa, a very firm Samoan massage. And when he lifted his hands away, the headache would be gone, just like Samoan magic. So I think the value of these traditional medicines has been really embedded in my life from an early age. And the idea behind the study is to work together in partnership with traditional healers, having Samoan oversight and governance, and here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, having that Māori governance to make sure that we do everything right, but trying to use Indigenous innovation to solve these global problems and to try and find accessible antivirals for our Pacific communities.
Traditional healing in Samoa obviously goes back thousands of years. What are, and then obviously in Aotearoa as well, what types of traditional remedies or practices that have historically helped treat people in these countries is still sort of practiced today?
Actually, particularly in Samoa, you know, we have to understand for most of our Pacific neighbours, their medical health systems don't have the same funding that a lot of higher income nations like Australia and Aotearoa New Zealand have. And so for a lot of these people in these nations, you know, if you get cancer, there's not necessarily the chemotherapy you need. If you have a viral disease such as COVID, there's not necessarily the antivirals that are accessible. And most of their health funding is spent on medical evacuations to other nations for care. And so if you think about it, there's this huge gap in antivirals and medicines there in the Pacific. And so really what this is, has come out of is that there are all these viral diseases and there's really no care. And so we're trying to find solutions for that together in partnership. And although I can't reveal the specific traditional medicines that can be used, because we have a trust system where we code name the traditional medicines that are sent to me, so I test them blinded. Nothing is stored in the cloud. We don't send anything over email. These measures are put in place to protect the indigenous intellectual property of the traditional medicine holders. We have to understand that this is a livelihood for a lot of these people, and so we can't be sharing the names of the plants. And so there's this whole sort of system of protection around keeping their knowledge safe and using their knowledge to feed back so that they can then use that information to better treat their patients. And so it's a really just layers of protection, and the whole idea of this study is that we will go forward and see what might work against viruses like dengue, measles and Zika and feed that back and then look at other options for pharmaceutical drugs. What is important is that we've already worked together with trusted partnerships with the Scientific Research Organization of Samoa, so SHROS, and we have found previously that there are two traditional medicines that are effective against the virus that causes COVID. So we're really hopeful that we'll be able to find some solutions for these other viruses too. And it's important to note, as you mentioned, these have been developed over millennia, but these were developed against traditional applications. So things that existed before Europeans arrived. But the fact is that when Europeans arrived, they brought all of these new viral diseases such as measles and influenza and smallpox. These are viruses that we didn't have traditional medicines developed against. So this is working in partnership to find new applications for these effective traditional medicines.
Have you faced any challenges in this process at all about trying to validate Indigenous medicinal knowledge, especially coming up against the Western health system?
I think what's really key here is that I really want to get the strong message across that this study is not about validation of traditional medicines. We absolutely know traditional medicines work against their traditional applications. This study is all about finding new applications for these existing traditional medicines, which we know are safe and effective against their original target disease. So one of the major challenges that we've faced is trying to incorporate this Indigenous innovation while protecting it. So it's really critical that we protect the intellectual property of these traditional knowledge holders while using it as a springboard of Indigenous innovation to find solutions against these viral diseases. And so to do that carefully, we have independent governance, and the governance group spans everything from government to clinical workers to community, traditional healers, sustainability groups. And the idea is that we do everything in a way that is not extractive. So the benefits need to come back into those communities from where that Indigenous knowledge comes from, and it's all around protecting that. So one of the challenges is trying to make sure we get that balance right so that we're protecting those traditional medicine healers and also building on that to find new applications. And so the only way you can do this is through true trusted partnerships, and we have a number of safeguards in place to protect that Indigenous knowledge.
One of the, I guess, concerns around traditional medicine or the system around it can be seen, I guess, in Samoa, obviously to do with measles. We've had outbreaks of measles where, sadly, many children have died. And there was a distrust of the Western health system and a distrust of vaccines. How do you see that juxtaposition, that tension moving forward? What is your message to people who might be hearing this about the importance of both vaccines and Western medicine, and also the importance of traditional Indigenous medicine as well?
Oh, look, that's such a great question, and I'm so glad you asked it. I think it's really important that everybody here's my message, and that prevention is always better than cure. You absolutely want to prevent things like measles if you can before you have to cure it. So I would say for those that can be vaccinated with MMR, I would absolutely encourage you. But the reality is that because of the type of vaccine that MMR is, not everyone can be vaccinated. And so people that are pregnant, or if you have a major problem with your immune system, or if you're under 12 months of age, if you're a little baby, then you can't be vaccinated with MMR. And so if you cannot prevent, then that's the point where I would say the wonderful solution that could come out of this study is an antiviral to treat measles infection. And we don't have that currently. So I see them as complementary, but I would always say that prevention is always better than cure.
And how long is this study going on for?
Yeah, so the idea is the study is a four-year study. I'm funded for 4 years to look at these solutions for dengue, Zika and measles. And we can look further from that if possible. But we're already working with trusted partners. So we've been working for some time on respiratory viruses and had some really exciting results to come out of that we're yet to get sign off to share, but really promising results there. And so we're hoping that within 4 years, we will be able to find what works against these viruses, feed that back to the traditional healers, and then they can start to implement that already with their patients. What's also important is that we can then find the bioactive properties, so the parts of the plant that are working as antivirals, and then work with chemists to make synthetic analog, so make like little tweaks on the chemical that's causing that antiviral activity so that we can patent that and then take that forward to be sort of through drug development and pharmaceutical trials and protect that indigenous traditional knowledge by slightly changing it and making sure that the patent benefits come back to those communities.
Well, it sounds very interesting and looking forward to seeing what results you might get. Dr. Netzler, thank you so much for joining me here this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. Go well.
That was Dr. Natalie Netzler, a senior lecturer at the University of Auckland, speaking to me there.
Want the latest Pacific Rugby League and Union news and interviews with stars of the game? Tune in to Nation Footy with Sam Wykes and Tinirau Arona.
That explains why she was avoiding us when we were trying to get her to do an interview in Fiji.
Now, that was you. She was avoiding you. I was all goods, but because we're a duo, she goes, nah, I can't because of him.
Nation Footy, Monday afternoons at 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Join Jacob McQuire and Michael Chow for Nisha Daily every weekday morning on ABC Radio Australia.
A new segment delving deep into hair, Michael Chow.
Yeah, and you named this, and I'm very proud of you, man. You called it Know Your Roots.
Ooh.
As in the roots of your hair, but also the roots of your culture.
Oh, I do what I can.
Nisha Daily, weekday mornings from 7 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat and to some sports news now. Super Rugby Pacific's opening round came to Lathoka's Churchill Park at the weekend, where the two Pacific teams in the competition went head to head. But it was an uneven match, with Moana Pacifica smashing the Fijian and drew up 40-26 to end the home team's three-year winning streak in Lautoka. Moana's number 8, Samisi Ta'aloa, crossed the line just after 5 minutes, and by halftime, the lead had increased to 28-12. It was much of the same in the second half, with the Ndrua unable to take advantage of a late surge to catch up to the visitors. Despite the departure of All Black Ardie Savea, who lifted Moana into the top 8 last season, the team appears to have maintained its impressive form from last year.
Very proud, I think, is the word that comes to mind for me. We're just really proud of the effort from our players. It was tough out there. As you said, it's a cauldron here in Lautoka. We knew that coming here. But I'm just proud of the way we stuck to our plan that we talked about, we trained. And then, obviously, you know, as it got later in the game, just proud of how much it means to them, to our team, to get. Our boys trained hard in the pre-season. Again, we asked them to come in fit. We didn't want to have to use a lot of our time together to work on fitness. We wanted to work on our rugby, you know, getting better at rugby. And to all the players. They did that. They've worked hard for the last, you know, 3 months, 6 months, however long it has been. This game's come around pretty quick. But our plan was to come here, be very efficient with our energy. That's all we wanted to be. It worked for the first 20 minutes, and then the heat took over, and then, again, the heart of our players and, again, you know, the cause of Moana Pacifica is what keeps driving us. No different to what the draw is, and we understand that as well.
Can you tell us about some of the players that you're especially excited about in this coming season?
Well, we were well led by our captain here, Maruko Failangi, and you know, it's the first time he's captain our side, and I thought he did an outstanding job, and he's been doing one, since we've been together. I thought our forwards really stepped up. We asked a lot of them today, but you know, I can't speak highly enough of all the players who are out there and did their jobs. That's what we talk about a lot, you know, just do your job, and you know, we know that's what's best for us.
What's up, ABC Radio Australia listeners? I'm Sosafina Formoli, and I want you to come hang with me for On The Record, your weekly deep dive into the music that moves the Pacific. We'll talk about the big tracks that inspire your favourite Pacific music artists and the real stories behind them. Plus, we'll uncover some gems that you might not know yet, keeping the heart of the Pacific alive and thumping. Catch On The Record Mondays at 3 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, the stories of young Fijian rugby players who run into trouble after signing an overseas contract are all too familiar. So now the FRU, working in partnership with the Fiji Rugby Players Association, have put a mandatory vetting process into place for anyone seeking a contract or scholarship abroad. The aim is to protect players from exploitative agreements that can put their welfare at risk and, in the worst cases, have even led to suicide. The FRU's chief executive, Koli Sawambu, says too many players have suffered as a result of loopholes in contracts that were not properly reviewed. So the chair of the Fiji Rugby Players Association, Ili Tambua, says the new protocol is designed to ensure that every player knows exactly what they are signing up for.
It is a big problem because, you know, the players just want to get over to play a bit of football in a new environment and hopefully an opportunity. And at the same time, the advice from home or from guardians is to pursue that dream. But it's the understanding of what you get involved in, your responsibility, the cost and everything that applies within the area. Most players that are coming through have been supported by guardians and parents, but if anything does happen, what are their backup? Is their support system? What happened if injuries occur? And those are fine lines between contractual issue that they should understand. Because in the past, there have been issues with players going abroad without understanding that. And when contracts have been terminated or they've been left stranded, and that's the challenge that we want to be addressed, what they're getting themselves into.
Would I be right in thinking that the worst thing a young player could do is sign any sort of contract which doesn't cover them should they become injured? Because this is the real serious issue, isn't it? When a young player gets injured through no fault of their own and the club they're with, in certain circumstances, gives up on duty of care and doesn't even pay them.
Most contracts are in the language of where they're going to be actually issued. So it has to be interpreted in layman's term here to understand. For them, they've always wanted to pursue that dream. But for us, it's the welfare and understanding of it, that if anything occurs, that they are being looked after and those that have a sign with them has a duty of care.
In the past, it's been suggested that some players or those looking after young players were reluctant to take their contracts to the Fiji Rugby Union because they were worried that that player might be prevented from taking up a contract overseas. But I think that was under a different regime. It's not like that now.
No, we wouldn't want to stop anybody pursuing that dream. It's the understanding of it. It's not only that, but now with having to have clearance from the national body and as well their contract vetted by the Players Association with affiliation of that the player is looked after. Our major concern here is the welfare of the players. and the understanding of their rights and responsibility, and vice versa to the clubs or the schools they're going into, that the best interests I'll look after here.
So in essence, what you're saying on the Players Association's part is that if a contract is offered, the player, their guardians, their parents, whoever is supervising it, should go straight to the union and have that contract properly examined to make sure it's watertight.
And because they've been registered at home, there has to be a release from the union to allow the player to move forth. And those certain criteria that we want, that has to be looked into before the release is been given to the player to move to the areas that they are pursuing in regards to scholarship or playing careers overseas.
What about your own experience in Europe?
There was a person during my coaching career went over there and had issues, and finally he committed suicide because of that. He had a young family to support, and the culture, the language, it's how best that we could support them and educate them into the environment so that they grow to be the person they dream to be.
If you come across a contract which, shall we say, has holes in it, as an association, what can you do about that? Would you go back to the club that's issued this contract and say that this is not right, you need to look at this, or just simply advise the player not to sign?
We do give them the advice. We write back to the clubs and should we got to address all of this. And at the same time, talk to the players. We got to address these certain issues before the release is actually being given to the players to go abroad.
So from now on, it's simple enough. Don't even hesitate. Get in touch with the union, start the process so that nobody, we hope in future, falls into the sort of holes that players have had in the past.
That's what we're looking into. In the past, a lot of players have gone overseas and then the clubs write back or the parties write back to get a release while they're already overseas. But here, what we're trying to say, be educated about and understand what you're getting yourself into. We can support and educate that. And before you even leave, you've got to cross the T's, dot your I's. And then if there's anything that you come across, we can always have the understanding of how we're going to support.
Ili Tambuya, chair of the Fiji Rugby Players Association, talking about the new safeguards put in place to protect players from dodgy overseas contracts. And he was talking to Richard Hewitt.
Pacific Beat.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Thank you so very much for your company this morning. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. But you can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because the news is next. And coming up after that is Nisha Daily.